Steve Morabito teaches composition, fiction, and poetry at the University of Pittsburgh, Greensburg. He was the recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Poetry. His short stories have appeared in such places as the North American Review, Antietam Review, Southwester, Brooklyn Review, Paper Street, and his poems have appeared in Beloit Poetry Journal, and I've seen them in Italian Americana and 5 a.m. He has three books of poetry out, Oswego Fugues, A Communion of Asiago, and Lowering the Body. He is going to be reading tonight from a collection of, actually, partly from poetry and partly from a short story book called Chasing St. George that's coming out. Came out from Star Cloud Press. So Steve will be reading short story, part of a short story, and some poetry. And I'm really happy to have him here reading tonight, Steve Morabito.
Thank you, Joan, and it's great to be back here. I remember reading here years ago with Buddy Norton, and if anybody has contact information, I'd love to get him a copy of my book, but I can't find where he moved to. Chasing St. George is a collection of 13 short stories. Six and one half take place in upstate New York, and six and one half take place in southwestern Pennsylvania. So I am a writer of place. Everybody is chasing something in this book. There's a bartender who's chasing sin. There's a sign maker who's chasing his past. There's a bowling alley owner who's chasing her own identity. And there's a boy who's chasing a girl, and they're both chasing a Saint Bernard. And you can see on the cover, the artist did a great job because the Saint Bernard is here, and she got the tail just right on that Saint Bernard. And she read the story, and she knew to put the boy chasing the girl. I'm going to read to you just the first page and a half. Chasing St. George takes place on the shoreline of Lake Ontario, and some people live there all year round. That's the thing you need to know. The boy lives there. His family lives there all year round. That I'm talking about, you could walk out your door and 30 feet, you're in the Great Lake. I don't know how they do it. That was the summer Cassie got the keys to her dad's trailer by the edge of the field. It was their old Dutchman, the one that Mrs. Kaz swore would sell in a day, the one Mr. Kaz swore no one would ever buy. He said, "Paula, what do they want with a trailer when they're down here in a family place or staying at lakeside cabins?" She said, "Vacationers have friends, Johnny. One of them is sure to want it." But he was right. Car after car flew past the blacktop, then over the gravel at the end of Shore Road. To us kids, it was where we lived year-round, but the fools from Oswego couldn't wait to hit the water, light their barbecues, or pop that first cold one. "They drive like assholes down here," my dad said. "Don't say asshole, honey, not around the boys. It's bound to ruin them," my mom said. "Oh, Daddy, they've heard that and a lot worse." "It's true. I mean, look at the muck they kick up. Johnny will never sell that trailer if you can't even see it through the dust." That was the summer I turned 13 and Cassie turned brown and got those freckles on her broad cheeks. Her hair was jet black, exactly like her mom's, and her eyes could be either blue or green, exactly like Lake Ontario, which was about 200 yards behind our houses, but off limits because our moms were so afraid that one of us kids would drown. With Mrs. Kaz, it was a daily obsession. She came out their front porch, looked left long enough to witness two or three white caps, and then spotting us on our bikes, her shoulders dropped, and she sighed back through the screened door. "Your mom thinks we're all going to drown or get run over by a car," my little brother Joe said. "What, is she mental?" "I don't know, but my dad says she's got too much time to think. He says she should get a job over the summer already." Cassie smiled at me. "He says all the other teachers do." We nodded. We agreed on everything, us kids. Cassie and her twin brothers, Timmy and Tommy, and me and Joe. Sometimes there were others, Bruce Dreyer or the Keegan sisters. "Come on, guys, let's go hunt frogs," Timmy said. And we were off, always riding or running to whatever was next. That was the summer Cassie got her white bathing suit, this two-piece pearly thing that looked like silk. Was I the only one who could see through it? That suit was forever wet, even if we were out in the sun for 5 hours. Through it, I saw her breasts, two-toned and large and round and always moving. Through it, I saw the rest of her, every crease and fold, all fluid and gleaming like a dream. So I brought some copies. This is Lowering the Body, and it's really my third book of the Oswego trilogy, the Oswego Fugues, Communion of Asiago, and then this. This is my way to say goodbye to that place. That's a store where my father and mother had the store on the corner of West 8th and Oneida in Oswego, New York. This was probably, you could walk to the lake from there. On the back, you can see the lake is probably about one block down the street. That's the Blizzard of 66. These poems take place in the 60s, and it's funny, like, do our poems really happen? Of course, you know, I try to write about places. Marianne Moore says poetry is real frogs in imaginary gardens. I think that's true, but I think my poetry and fiction are imaginary frogs, but they're in very, very real gardens. However, my father has convinced me that this may have indeed really happened. It's called Eating Pepperoni on Good Friday, and I dedicated it to my son, Sebastian. After stealing the magic stick from my father's meat case, I try to think of where to go, not into the closet off the kitchen where the smell will hang with that of salty boots, not down to the cellar with the webs on my face or out back to the 50 Buick. I must go where only my punishment can follow. I go up to the roof, high over 8th Street. Only God above the oaks can spot me, the weight of my sin hard in my hands. Oh, it's terrible, I know, to eat Pastucci Brothers on Good Friday. Everybody in dark rooms, the thin Bible pages turning slowly to the sorrowful mysteries. And I'm caught as the chimney stack hisses red with anger. Okay, I accept it. I will pick each sandy grain from every last rooftop on 8th Street. I will be sentenced to an eternity of shingles, standing here forever, veils of steam from Friday flounder rising without me. Yes, but first, this bite, teeth breaking, salty skin, smell drifting straight to heaven. This is another grocery store poem. Well, they're all grocery store poems. It's called This Is My Ode. And then after this, I'll read one more poem, and if I have time, maybe others, but I wanted to definitely read these two. This is my ode. We weren't allowed to let Uncle Ted into the kitchen, just give him a new Jenny in the living room. Oh, this is my ode to the sweet, foamy head of 60s psychotherapy. But no, a cook on early retirement, he'd lose his balance, go astray, as Cousin May said. Like when Ted cleaned fresh clams in the dishwasher. Oh, this is my ode to all those sudsy yawners. My ode to the perversion of soapy grinners. My ode to that trigger inside of us all moved by what? The mention of pastrami or a dead wife's name. I saw it when he was behind the deli, when the fire department ordered pastramis and someone mentioned Aunt Peggy's name. Oh, this is my ode to heaping mayo on corned beef and my father storming out of his own store, bells howling at the door. Ted didn't even appear to like the thing he'd made. He simply stood there on the sawdust and regarded it at arm's length, eyes saying, no, this isn't the piece I had thought, but if I flee the world far enough, oh, hear me now. This is my ode to a man setting down a sin of a sandwich and calmly walking away, not a white hair out of place. This is my ode to cold and entombed pain, to Ted in the intersection of West First and Bridge, the don't walk sign freezing him in his steps, the world blowing its horns of forced stillness and outrage at a man whose wife dropped dead in her at her ironing board, and he said that over and over to the cops in their cruiser as the people paused with their hands up to their mouths or their palladium times folded under their arms. This is my ode to the biggest pastrami sandwiches I'd ever seen, gaping smilers with tongues hanging out like the tired runners we were that day, all the way downtown with our layers and layers and layers of meat, mustard and cheese and the Dortmunder pickles we'd fished out. I carried the Campbell soup box into the police station, and we fed the cops, who said, "Don't worry, just give him a Jenny and help him calm down." That way, they knew him for years as the cook over at Vona's, how he and his wife shared a hot pastrami in the back booth on Friday nights. Oh, this is my ode to the one cop's simple logic, with mustard on his chin and the rest of their happy mouths sinking into those monstrosities as we walked out into the blistering August afternoon of 1965, Ted like a child holding my hand. How such strange flesh engulfs your soul. We got him back home, and my father turned at the door, looking cold and confused as he returned to his orders. This is my ode to those eyes. Those wordless eyes. As I handed Ted the beer in the cool, doilied, brown, bottled darkness. This is my ode to the way he took it, sipped it, and then lowered his head, to the way I looked at my mother and my cousin May, who both stood looking from the dining room, to the way the sun burst in through the latticed Venetian blind, igniting their colorless work clothes, igniting their dark arms, igniting their paused, pondering faces, igniting for me, for the first time, more than those resilient olive faces. The last poem I'll read, am I doing okay? Okay, the last poem is called My Mother Joins the Hippies. And now, you know, I thought that I was almost done with this book. And this poem is special to me because you know, when I was growing up, the Vietnam War was going on, and we saw the so-called Oswego Nine, the college kids who had the big protests, and in the city, there was a big, big split between how the citizens saw the college kids. I had relatives who loved the college kids. They pushed me out of a ditch. I don't care if he's got long hair. He pushed me out of a ditch, you know? And they, we had relatives who obviously thought, and people came in the store, and the store was a turnstile. People were always arguing about the hippies. Well, anyway, when I discovered that in 1960, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, around in there, those whole years, that if you were pregnant and showing you couldn't teach grammar school, that would have pissed my mother off, okay? And that's why I wrote this poem. My mother would have definitely protested with the hippies. My mother joins the hippies. And one more thing, this poem really to me was the last poem I wrote for this book, and when I wrote it, I knew it was done. Yeah, I don't know if you know what I mean, but you do. When I was done with this poem, the book is done because the store was done. You know, this kind of thing, one culture came, another left. My mother joins the hippies. They came down from the hill of Oswego State again, frayed bell bottoms, flowing hair, a river of tie-dyed acid colors, headbands, peace necklaces, granny sunglasses, beads, vests, boots, sandals, and braided leather belts that made them look like the Franciscans who taught us Sunday school. The hippies turned south off bridge and silently carried their signs on 8th, moving past the grocery store, emptied now of awestruck customers who clung to their wrapped roasts, their quarts of milk, their pounds of olives, their loaves of bread, who clung to the corner of West 8th and Oneida itself. This time, it wasn't the latest LBJ troop surge in Vietnam and the City Hall sit-in with its chance of make love, not war, that produced the Oswego Nine, still awaiting trial. No, this time the hippies protested because our own Mrs. Thompson, down on Mohawk Street, had been forced from her second-grade classroom at Layton Elementary. She was 3 months pregnant and showing. When the story broke in the neighborhood, it moved woman to woman, yard to yard, like a swarm of angry bees, and my mother's dark Polish face hardened from beauty to political outrage. Politics is bad for business. Stay out of it, my father yelled, into the wall behind the meat counter. Those aisles kept them from killing each other when they disagreed. They waited until it was only just us kids, he in the produce aisle pretending to straighten heads of lettuce, and she in the canned goods aisle pretending to block the shelves. They shouted to each other things they could never say at home. His arguments rounded displays of Del Monte peaches, her retorts bounced off boxes of Kellogg's cornflakes, and the air inside the store was somehow the final arbiter. They taught us fair exchange, one finally turning silent, nodding, picking up a broom and sweeping forward for us all. But that time, at her checkout counter, she ignored him by stocking Nestle bars, T-berry gum, and Marlboros, while insisting to customers, right is right, wrong is wrong, and there's nothing wrong with a pregnant woman teaching second grade. Then she whipped that rotary dial phone until she stood informing our principal, well then, shop elsewhere for your liverwurst and monk's bread. It took months for my father to learn she had banned Dr. Berlander, but it only took seconds for her to cross 8th Street in her uniform, carrying the grocery stamper higher and higher like some kind of baton. Mrs. Berlin, Mrs. Ferraro, and Mrs. Grimaldi joined the hippies too. They shook hands, talked, and nodded, no one looking a bit out of place. They would chant all the way to Dr. Berlander's house on 6th and Utica. Customers looked to my father to do something, but then ambled home. He shrugged his shoulders, ushered us inside, closed the store for the day, went behind the meat counter, and cut down a hanging provolone. He nodded as he carved away the wax, kept on nodding as he sliced Genoa, tore bread, poured olives, and opened up bottles of pop in Genesee. Stretching on the sawdust, he addressed the two remaining cheeses. This one talks but says nothing. This one says nothing but knows everything. My brother Mike wanted to know, so how do they get along? Go figure, he said. Maybe it's a bigger window than they know. Of course, we had no idea what the hell he was talking about. We just giggled as his story grew with the voices of knives and saws and scales. His hands opened, and he looked so much like my grandfather that I ached, but only until the sharp cheese and rich olives filled the air, and the first sweet burn of the Coca-Cola swept it all away. Thanks for having me.